Hello, hello. Very nice to see everybody. Who you are seeing next to me is Nevin Freeman, who is the CEO of the Reserve Protocol Project, which is a cryptocurrency project. And to be more specific, it's a stablecoin cryptocurrency project. And that is very interesting for me because that is much more aligned with the channel in the sense that there are a lot of cryptocurrency projects out there that are all about, is the price going to go up and are people going to make a lot of money? Whereas this crypto project is about, can we create a new private or decentralized money system? And then especially that might be useful for emerging markets, which have to deal with inflation and even hyperinflation. So that's why I was very excited when I got a message from the team over at the Reserve Project, if I was interested in doing this interview. And I am. It will be a bit different perhaps than many of the other interviews that they have done before, because we will just focus on the economics, because I'm not a blockchain expert. I know just the basics, but I am an economist. And I'm really looking forward to this chat. Nevin, can you quickly introduce yourself, at least the parts that I haven't already covered, and then maybe tell us a little bit about the Reserve Project and why you started it? What's the goal of this?
Yeah, totally. Let me first just say I'm super appreciative of you for having me on your channel. I'm a fan of yours. I like the material you put out, and I really like how you make things accessible so quickly. Every time I watch one of your videos, I'm like, oh yeah, totally, like full of insight. So super, super appreciate that. And thanks for having me. My name is Nevin. I'm one of the co-founders and currently the CEO of the Reserve Project. And I forget what else. Did you want me to go ahead and like introduce the project right now? Or
Yeah, that would be great. Like, yeah. Especially if we can get into sort of what your goal is. What do you want to achieve with the project?
Yeah, totally. So the project has two goals. There's the short-term goal, which I feel like pretty confident that we're going to achieve, although we still have work to do. And then there's a long-term goal, which is very ambitious, and who knows if we'll be able to achieve it. The short-term goal is to use cryptocurrency to help people cope with hyperinflation and high inflation circumstances. And so the way that that works is by making a US dollar pegged stablecoin, and in particular, making it accessible to people in countries that have high inflation or hyperinflation. And we do that today through like a simple mobile app. So it's basically like a digital dollar account that's powered by crypto in the background. And that is relevant. Some people ask, like, do you really need crypto to do that? The answer is yes. And it's a little bit subtle as to why. We could talk about that if you're curious. And the challenge there is making markets between these currencies and digital US dollars so that people can easily move their money in and out, usually in a matter of seconds. And so, so the goal really there is to make it so that people have the choice to save in dollars and increasingly even just spend directly in dollars if they want to. And I'm excited to talk to you about your views on dollarization and all of that, because we are, in a sense, supporting dollarization or furthering it.
Yeah.
The long-term goal is to create a fiat alternative, like a new type of stable currency that's a little bit different from what has quite ever existed before in the world. Because, you know, in the past we've had, you know, we've used precious metals as currencies, and then we've migrated to, you know, fiat currencies. And so there's some history of the idea of like commodity-based money, but it's never been logistically practical to aggregate together like a huge diversified basket of different commodities and asset types, and then have that the representation of that basket be used as a currency. And that's not actually true, because with like the internet and modern technology, we actually could have done that a long time ago. But like from like a legal perspective and like a trust perspective and a governance and administration perspective, that actually hasn't really been feasible to do that in like a politically neutral way, to have a sort of decentralized, diversified asset-backed currency. And so that's something that we dream of doing. And we have a protocol that's meant to be able to do that. And that's, you know, the long-term goal is to actually achieve that and offer like a true alternative stable currency that isn't based on a fiat system.
Yeah, all right. So that's actually great for me that there's already a little bit of new information in there, although I saw it a little bit in your white paper, and that is this long-term goal. But for now, I really want to get into the short-term goal first, because that is already, I think there's just economically speaking, a lot to unpack there. I'm not really going into the crypto side. I'll just believe you for now that crypto is necessary to get this done, and you can't do it in a centralized way. We might talk about it at the end, but I already have a ton, really a ton of questions for you. And the first thing is, like, how I think it would be interesting, just from a financial perspective, to get a little bit into this, like how you structured this project, because that also relates very much to stablecoins. And I don't think everybody knows sort of what stablecoins are and how they work. And for me, I think what we'll also get into a little bit is what you mentioned, is that in the cryptosphere, there is this really strong, I think, drive to move back to commodity money. I guess it's also part of you, because you mentioned it. But what you're doing now, to me, seems very much like private bank money creation. And you're building completely, as I understand it, on fiat. So I think there's an interesting tension there. I'll definitely give you the opportunity to resolve all of that. But what I wanted to do is share a little bit of a balance sheet that I built, because this is something that I do frequently on my channel. I try to explain how banking works through balance sheets, because I think that is a great way to clarify sort of what takes a lot of words to write down. So if I may share this with you and with everybody, then we can talk about it that a little bit. But perhaps you can start while I set that up by quickly going over the basics of what you have now. Let's start there, like the different types of tokens there are and how that works.
Yep, totally. So first off, the basic building block that powers the stablecoin that we have today is fiat-backed, US dollar-backed stablecoins. And the way that those work is essentially like a private version of a currency board, right? So you can bring one US dollar to the issuer, and they'll give you one fiat-backed stablecoin token on Ethereum or another blockchain. And then you can send that token around to anyone. Anyone can bring that token back to the issuer, and as long as they pass the KYC process, they can redeem it for one US dollar. And in practice, you know, market makers tend to do that millions of dollars at a time, but that's the basic functionality of an ordinary US dollar-backed fiat-backed stablecoin.
Yeah.
The way that the reserve token works today is it's a little bit like, it's kind of like an ETF that's just backed by those fiat-backed stablecoins.
Can I quickly stop you? Shared my screen with you and also with everybody else. Can I just quickly ask the people in the chat if they can actually see this? Because
I see it on the stream. Actually don't see it on Discord, but I see it on the stream. So I think that means there'll be a little bit of lag, but it should work.
Okay, then I'll just stop streaming it to you on Discord, and we just rely on the stream then. So you were talking about the reserve tokens just now, right?
Yes.
And they are a claim on the collateral tokens.
That's right.
Which are, I think, a claim on real assets, like USD treasuries, repo, perhaps?
Right now, right now the collateral tokens are just a claim on US dollars. And so those stablecoin issuers, you know, if you send them, you know, 100,000 US dollars, they'll give you 100,000 stablecoins. And then they might take those assets and, you know, purchase treasuries or something that's interest bearing, right? That's their business model, is to earn some amount of return on that underlying collateral capital that you've sent them. But when you redeem them, you're just redeeming for US dollar cash.
Yeah. All right. So I think I've drawn that out a little bit. So your collateral tokens are based on USD type coins, other stable coins, and they are then based on treasury repo. And your reserve tokens are basically a claim on these collateral tokens.
Yep, that's right.
Okay, excellent. Right. Go ahead.
And well, I think there's a natural question there of like, well, why? Like, what's the point? Why not just use those US dollar stable coins directly? So just one piece of context there is that it makes it so that we're not dependent on any particular of those stablecoin issuers, because if any one of them were to, say, run into a regulatory roadblock and decide to shut down, or they decided that their system would be permissioned and couldn't be used permissionlessly, for example, then that portion of the collateral tokens could be traded out for other stable coins of equivalent value. So it means that we can create this end user token, the reserve token that people use in our app and they can use in the crypto ecosystem. And that can continue to have the same value, even if those sort of middleware level fiat-backed stable coins have to be swapped out for some reason or another over the next 5 years or something.
Yeah. All right. Okay. I think that makes sense. I'm glad you mentioned that because I didn't yet read that. But I think you also have plans to transition very quickly to just buying in a decentralized way these types of assets yourself, right? Is that correct?
So the thing is, we don't ever want to have like a stablecoin that people are expecting to be backed by one type of thing, you know, suddenly switch and be backed by something else. So the current stablecoin that's backed by these US dollar stablecoins should always stay that way. Mm-hmm. But we can issue additional stablecoins. And actually, our smart contracts can be used by anyone to issue additional stablecoins. And so that means that you can create, like, let me tell you about the next one that we're excited to deploy in, you know, sometime at the end of this year or early next year. Well, I guess this goes pretty deep down the crypto rabbit hole, depending on whether you know much about DeFi or not. But I think that you'll understand it, even if not. So in DeFi, you can lend out your US dollar stablecoins trustlessly, like on Ethereum, where what happens is you deposit your stablecoins into a smart contract, and then someone else can come and borrow those stablecoins by posting volatile assets like ETH, for example, as collateral. Mm-hmm. And you can generate some amount of interest on that. You know, like right now, maybe it's around 5% per year or something, lending out your stablecoins in that trustless way. Well, the next version, the next stablecoin that we'll issue, instead of being backed directly by US dollar stablecoins, it's actually backed by tokens that are produced by these lending protocols like Compound and Aave, which and those tokens are a claim on the underlying like stablecoins that got lent out through those lending protocols, including any interest that's been generated, you know, and so you add this further step of indirection.
Can I just pause you there quickly and see if I'm still with you? So you're working on these reserve tokens. I just called them version 2, right? And they are meant to be lent out with collateral, or there should be collateral on these loans. Is that correct?
Yeah, so let me explain it like a little bit mechanistically just to make sure that it's clear, because it's a little bit counterintuitive. So if you go to Compound right now and you deposit, you know, 100 USDC.
What is Compound?
You will get a Compound. Okay, so Compound is a decentralized lending protocol. It's super interesting. The way that it works is you can go and deposit stable coins. For example, USDC is like a very popular and safe stablecoin you could use on Compound. Mm-hmm. And you're basically saying, okay, it's kind of like putting your money into a bank. And then the bank is going to lend out the money, except in this case, the bank is just a smart contract. And so the bank doesn't do any credit worthiness assessment of individuals. It doesn't know anything about the individuals who are borrowing. And that might sound completely crazy, except that all of the loans that it makes are over-collateralized.
Right.
And
this,
so
actually, this is not crazy at all. This is very much how repo works, and also how, for example, asset-backed securities work. So this is something that is where a lot of sort of scholars are working on what they call market-based banking, which is actually a feature, something that I just taught in one of my courses, where this also happens. That because you have this collateral, and it's typically also in repo over collateralized, they call it a haircut, meaning that you get less money than what you post in collateral. So the consequence of that is that banks no longer have to do sort of the credit check, because they're very confident that they can always get their money back. It's very similar, right?
Excellent. Yes, very similar. Yeah, it's basically the exact same principle. So except the thing is, the borrowers in a system like Compound are generally crypto speculators who want to go, like, you know, they want to take a leveraged long position on their assets. So they could go and deposit, for example, some Ethereum as collateral, and borrow stablecoins and then go buy more ETH. And that's a common use case for these lending protocols. And because of that, the interest rates that you get to lend out your stablecoins through these protocols tend to follow crypto market cycles. If the crypto market is bullish, lots of people want to go margin long, and so they'll pay you a lot to borrow your stablecoins. And if the crypto markets are down, then the rates will be a lot lower because people aren't as excited about gambling on crypto assets.
Yeah. Okay, I see. Yeah. So the yields there are very much tied to the profits that are just being made in crypto.
Yep.
Okay. Excellent.
And so then the way that this works then is like you can go deposit your stablecoins into, say, Compound, and that gives you your balance gets tokenized. Unlike a bank account, you now have a token that you can send to me, and then I could go redeem that token with Compound to get out the underlying stablecoins plus the interest that's been earned. And so once you get those tokens that represent that balance, you can actually go then mint this new reserve stablecoin by depositing those tokens instead of depositing stablecoins directly. So it's not that people deposit stablecoins into reserve and the reserve goes and talks to Compound. Instead, it's that the person who's minting that new kind of reserve token, they have to have already created those deposits within Compound or another protocol called Aave, and then they take those tokens that represent those balances, and they go deposit them to mint the reserve stablecoin. And the net effect of that is that the reserve stablecoin is now backed by those positions in those lending protocols. And so then that reserve stablecoin is automatically accruing whatever interest is accrued to those balances.
Okay. So let me just try to recap that a little bit, because I think for an economist like myself, this was all very fast, with a lot of terms that are quite foreign to me. But was this your description of how sort of the lent out tokens, what they do? Or was this also your description of what's happening on your liability side of the reserve protocol itself?
Yeah, so the liability for this reserve token V2, as you've labeled it, is for, I use the term DeFi bearer instruments or bearer assets, because these tokens that you get out of Compound when you've created a position, they're bearer instruments in that, you know, you can send them to anyone and anyone can then redeem them for that underlying stable coins that you initially deposited into that lending protocol along with any interest.
Okay, so can I just quickly interrupt you to make sure that I'm still following? If I want to get your reserve tokens V2, I deposit stable coins. Not USD. Is that correct?
Yeah. So you like if you started off with USD, you could go to the stablecoin issuers and issue the initial stablecoins. Then you could take those stablecoins and go to Compound and deposit them into Compound to get, you know, those tokens that represent Compound positions. And then you could go deposit those into the reserve protocol to get this new reserve stablecoin.
Okay, excellent. And then what you do with the stablecoins that have been deposited is you lend them out again. Is that correct?
Well, no. So that's the interesting thing, because the tokens that get deposited into the reserve smart contract represent balances of stablecoins that have already been made available to borrow through Compound. So that means that our protocol doesn't actually do any lending. Our protocol is still doing the same thing as it is in the first reserve token case. It's just holding those tokens and making them available to redeem. But those, you see what I'm saying. So like the lending is already happening in a different smart contract.
Yeah. Okay. So that is. So I need to change this. These are these other USD stablecoins directly. These USD coins already.
Yeah, and so. I don't know if it will make it clearer or less clear, but Compound has like a naming convention, for example, where if you have a token, say DAI, like DAI is a popular stablecoin, DAI.
Yeah.
If you deposit DAI into Compound, you get a token that's called CDAI, like lowercase c and then DAI. And so our protocol wouldn't hold DAI, it would hold CDAI for the reserve token V2.
Okay, so like see DAI. Can I say that? So yeah. you have, that's the asset that your reserve token V2 is a claim on.
Right. That's
okay.
Great.
Okay. Excellent. Okay.
Yeah. And a basket of different such assets, but yeah.
Yeah. And then I'll just end the like. Okay. That's really interesting. So this is new for me. It does still remind me a lot of what's happening in repo markets or asset-backed security markets. But now I do have a question. So because I do want to get into the economics, but I do think it's also important to understand what's actually going on. But my question is, if we can go back to your goal, your short-term goal, helping people in emerging market economies. One question that came to mind for me is if they want to mint currency because they are in need of currency, right? Then they need to have these stable coins to begin with, right? Isn't that a bit tricky for them?
Well, it's a great question. So the thing is that an ordinary end user never would really have a reason to mint or redeem these stable coins. They would just be purchasing them from another user or from a liquidity provider. And so the minting and redeeming actually only happens very infrequently. And that's actually sort of similar to fiat-backed stable coins in general, where like an ordinary crypto speculator wouldn't go mint a fiat-backed stablecoin on a normal day. They would just be buying or selling it on an exchange. So in our case, I could actually, I don't know if you're interested in this, but I could share my screen and show you a live 1-minute demo of the app of like what it's like for a user in Venezuela to buy the stablecoin if you're curious.
Oh, that would actually be great. Let me just put you on the stream again and see if that works. Let's give it a try. I think that would be great because I do want to get back to, you know, what's happening on the ground. And I do have another question about that. But let's see first how it works. I think that's a very, very good point. Let's see if we can get that
one
going.
Second to set
yeah,
up.
Yeah. Let me just see if what people are saying in the chat. Jabbar says, I understand the play now. Oh, yeah. Zybernetic says, what did Minsky say about anyone being able to create money? He said, everybody is able to create money. The problem is just to get it accepted as payment.
Exactly. That's totally true. That's absolutely true. The way we think about it is, yeah, it's like anyone can create a token, but it's very hard to create a currency.
Yeah. And Joshua was defending me in the chat that I do know a bit more about crypto than I let on. Thanks, Josh. Yeah, I think this is interesting. I don't know who is watching, but I suspect that a lot of actually people who saw your message on Twitter are also watching. And then a lot of people who typically watch the Money and Macro channel are watching. And these are very different worlds. Or, I mean, we have overlap, of course. And that's why I really want to dumb it down to sort of synchronize this. Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to share my screen on Discord. Do you think that will work?
Yeah, that should actually work. Yeah. Let's see if it does. Yeah, we are seeing this.
So you see like dollar balance now?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So this is our app. It basically is, you know, if you've used like Cash App or Venmo, you know, it's kind of a copy of Cash App or Venmo. The thing that's special about it that we've achieved so far that we're super excited about is the methods for getting money in and out of your balance. Once you have money in the system, we even just label it as USD. You can just, you know, type in a number and send it to another username, or you can scan a QR code to pay at a local merchant. And there's about 8,000 merchants where you can pay directly now, mainly in Venezuela. But so you can deposit or withdraw with like Venezuelan bolivars or Argentine pesos or Colombian pesos or various different cryptocurrencies. And so I'll show you right now, I'll make a withdrawal to a Venezuelan bolivar bank account.
So you are depositing now, or are you? You're getting USD to another Venezuelan bank. Is that what you're doing now?
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to take $5, and it's telling me that I'll get 22.2 Venezuelan bolivars.
Right.
And that would have been 22.2 million as of a month ago, but the currency has been redenominated.
Oh yeah. Okay. They've striped off a few zeros.
Yeah. Okay. So I already have a Bolivar bank account connected. So I'm just going to accept here, type in my PIN for the whole world to see.
Nice. And write that down, chat.
Yeah. And now this transaction is in process. And so what's happening in the background is, okay, now the transaction is complete. So in those few seconds, a lot happened. So I, as a user, got matched with one of many different, we call them independent liquidity providers in Venezuela. And those are like foreign exchange brokers who basically are connected to the reserve system waiting to take such transactions. And so I got matched with one of them, and my reserve stablecoin balance in a centralized way in the reserve database for this app got transferred to that liquidity provider. And yep. Then in response to that, that liquidity provider sent out a Venezuelan Bolivar transaction for 22.2 Venezuelan Bolivars to the bank account that I had connected.
Okay, and hold on. Is the liquidity provider, is that a Venezuelan bank?
It's not a bank. They're using a Venezuelan banking account to make the transaction, but the liquidity provider is an independent business. Because okay. in a country like Venezuela, when you have hyperinflation and like capital controls, which those have been dramatically loosened since then, but you get a whole lot of independent businesses springing up to provide liquidity to allow people to trade back and forth between, you know, foreign currency, usually the US dollar, and the local currency. So we just went and found a bunch of existing businesses that already provide liquidity between normal US dollars and Venezuelan bolivars, and we plugged them into this system, because normally they would only really want to provide that service to larger, like high net worth people or businesses, so they can do large trades at a time. And they wouldn't want to do like a $5 transaction like this. It wouldn't be worth their time and energy. But through automation and like building a marketplace, we've made it profitable for those currency brokers that ordinarily wouldn't touch normal like retail people to provide the same service to ordinary retail people through this application. So that's fundamentally sort of the innovation there.
Okay. And then the brokers are connected to the USD system.
The brokers, yeah. So the brokers are connected, like they have balances in our reserve stablecoin in this app ecosystem, just like the normal users. And so, yeah, they're willing to buy and sell. And I'll show you right now. If you look at the price to buy dollars, you know, to make a deposit, which is effectively buying dollars, you'd pay 4.58 bolivars. Whereas if you're selling, you only get 4.44. And that spread is how the independent liquidity providers make their money.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. And why are the independent liquidity providers, so these are like the middlemen, right? They make the connection between your application and the Venezuelan banking system in this case, right?
Yep.
So why are they, why is this better for them than, you know, if this was just a USD bank account?
So they actually don't care. So now we get to the part where, like, why does it matter that it's crypto?
Yeah.
We
still got to it. Okay.
No.
I think it's
an important question.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an important question. So a lot of people think about cryptocurrency as being interesting because the individual at the, like, sort of the end user can hold it directly and be fully in control of their money and be subject to, you know, fewer rules and limitations. And that's true. What people don't realize is that the same thing applies on the business level. So we as a business offering this service to people in Venezuela, if we wanted to have all of these balances held directly in the banking system in the US, that would be very difficult. It'd be very difficult to persuade any US banking institution, hey, we're going to open up lots and lots of subaccounts for people in Venezuela.
Yeah.
But because we're using a cryptocurrency, we're holding custody of those crypto assets. And then those are backed by US dollars, by those initial stablecoin issuers. But they're not directly responsible for who our customers are. It actually has created, from a regulatory perspective, a layer of separation where we can take on our own responsibility directly for our end users and make sure that we don't, for example, deal with anyone who's sanctioned by the US government And so like we have a very careful compliance program and very careful filters for who can get into the app and so on and so forth. But we don't need to persuade a US banking institution to bank those customers. And so what this means is that it prevents like US banking institutions from censoring us as a business, as opposed to preventing, you know, us from censoring our users. Like we can still censor our users. We can still shut down our users' accounts. And law requires that we do that sometimes. In the longer term, we can take that one step further and make it so that users can hold these balances directly in the app. And we are going to do that. And that does provide further benefit and further protection for those individuals, where at that point, we can't take away their money and we can't like, you know, prevent them from making large transactions or anything like that. And I think that that is actually, honestly, good for the world. The reason why we haven't done that yet is because the transaction fees on Ethereum are way too high. And we didn't want to switch to a different blockchain. So there's this whole complicated crypto discussion of how to make transactions cheaper and faster. And we're going through that like technological process along with the rest of the ecosystem before we can allow people to hold the tokens directly. Yeah. But it's still actually not the case that we could have offered the service to Venezuelans had we not used crypto to custody those US dollars.
Right, because you're basically acting like a bank, but you're not a bank. And that's beneficial for you because you're not regulated like a bank. Is that correct?
That's part of it. But like even say PayPal or Cash App, they're not banks. They're money service businesses that rely on banks to hold the assets for their customers. But that means that they're dependent on permission from those banks. They need banks to be willing to hold the custody for those users. And that's really where the rub is. If you want to offer service to people in a country like Venezuela, and this is probably true also for people in like Lebanon today, it'd be difficult to get US banks to be willing to provide service to you as a fintech company. Yeah. And so basically us being able to take matters into our own hands and hold custody of those funds directly via the crypto assets, that's the key. That's what makes the difference.
Okay. I think so I would still view that as, I think the econ sort of technical term, it would be regulatory arbitrage. And I know that this has a lot of negative connotations, but I don't mean it necessarily as that. But this is just for me to sort of make the most sense of it, why you are operating like a bank, but you're not a bank, and that you can provide a service to these people that you would otherwise not be able to. And you did mention that there are a couple of ways why this, how this works, like what regulations, you know, you don't have to then do. Did I summarize that in a fair way?
Yeah. And it's actually, I think that's a fair high level summary. I think it slightly mischaracterizes the situation because we're actually not subject to any less regulation. It's just that we're like fundamentally what's happening is we don't have to deal with any other business's risk assessment. Ordinarily, a fintech company needs its banking partners, like the compliance and risk team from its banking partners, to decide it's worth it to deal with this business. Whereas in our case, there's no other banking partner involved that has to decide it's worth it to deal with us as a business. Mm-hmm. We're still subject to the exact same regulations in terms of anti-money laundering that we would be if we were an ordinary fintech. So it's basically making it so that we can control our own destiny and we take on that responsibility and liability directly instead of it sort of being like passed through the bank. But I think it's still fair to call it regulatory arbitrage.
Okay, great. So can I just then, I think this is a good segue into my comparison to a bank. I'm going to share this on the stream now, because if you would go over with me quickly. So can you see this?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. So what do you look like? And I think we've changed a couple of the stuff. You have your collateral tokens, and they are based on all sorts of stuff. And there's more of a role for other stablecoins than I previously thought. But they rely again on repo, USD treasury, and all of that. And stop me at any point that I'm talking nonsense. And then you have your reserve tokens, which are very liquid claims on these collateral tokens, and can be used as money. And I think they're also redeemable at any point if you want.
The reserve stablecoins are redeemable at any point.
Okay, excellent. Yeah. And then we haven't talked about those yet. Can you quickly, then you have reserve right tokens. And what my notes about these were is they can cover losses of specific reserve tokens. But this is on a somewhat voluntary basis. And they then can earn a fee for that. Is that a correct description?
Yes.
Okay, great. Now, on the right side, you see what I typically study. And this is a very liquid market-based bank. And they typically hold the super liquid stuff like repo, USD treasuries, also money market mutual fund shares, which are extremely liquid. And they hold deposits, which are claims on stuff on the asset side, but in a very short-term way. And equity serves to cover the loss, you know, any losses on assets, because then deposits won't have to bear them. And in exchange, equity earns, a profit. So this is extremely similar, right? I'm not saying it's the same, but is that a fair comparison?
Yeah, I think it is a fair comparison. And as you pointed out, you know, there is the slight difference of the reserve rights token holder having to choose to essentially provide that insurance function in exchange for the fees for any given stablecoin, rather than just being in that position by default. But it seems like that's the main difference.
Yeah. And also, I think, if I understood it correctly, a big difference is that reserve tokens are claims on very specific parts of the asset side, whereas deposits are sort of a broad claim on all assets. Is that also correct?
Well, let's see. What do you mean? So in the case of the normal bank deposits, what do you mean about them being a broad claim?
Well, okay, maybe I'm missing a deposit is like, in a way, every liability is a claim on the asset side of an institution, of a bank. But a deposit mm-hmm. is specifically a claim on money deposited. And the idea is that the bank can sell these assets, preferably one-to-one with dollars, and get back those deposits. But a deposit is not tied to any specific instrument, like one repo contract
right.
or one treasury.
Right. Right.
Whereas your reserve right. tokens, that's the impression I got, are tied to yeah. their own yeah. little specific collateral yeah. tokens.
Yeah, that's right. And so once you've deposited the collateral is fungible, you know, can be redeemed by somebody else. But yeah, and that's why I compared it to an ETF. It's because to mint the token, you have to deposit exactly the entire basket. And then when you redeem the token, you also get exactly the entire basket.
Ah, okay. Okay. So you do have to... Yeah, okay. So that I didn't get from your white paper. So you have to token the deposit the entire basket here, because I was yep. wondering if it's different than the reserve tokens might trade at slightly different prices, but that's not the case because it's the exact basket, correct?
Right. And yeah. And so that makes issuance and redemption pretty inconvenient. And like I said before, it's not really something that a normal end user would do. It's more what a market maker or a liquidity provider would be likely to do, because it is pretty inconvenient.
Yeah. But then if this analysis is correct, so I would like to have your opinion on something that stood out to me as a somewhat ironic way of state of crypto, in the sense that, and now we're getting back to this, crypto has a very strong commodity money culture that frowns upon private money creation. But what you're doing is pure private money creation in the same way that banks do it, right? Like your reserve tokens are extremely similar to private deposit creation. Is that correct? And do you also see the irony? I'm not saying that this is you're inconsistent in this, but do you see sort of what I mean?
I think I see what you mean, but I want to make sure, like, I think I can maybe learn a little bit from you right now. So when you talk about private money creation, do you specifically mean the sort of like expansion of the money supply in some sense from the lending that happens? Or are you saying that money creation occurs even like without lending happening? Just if you're depositing money into like a full reserve bank that doesn't lend it out or something?
Yeah, so that's a good question. Like if in a banking case, like sort of how I describe money creation in the most simple example, it would be that a loan is given out to a customer and that customer receives new deposits for that. So that is really clear and pure money creation. But something that's very close to it is that the government would issue debt and that the bank is the buyer, and how the bank then purchases this is with newly created deposits. So it's, yeah, I think as you can see that that is extremely similar. Another way to look at this is that the bank, because it's like in one of my videos, how credit money transformed medieval Europe, I think it was, I made the case that you can also look at this as the bank monetizes the debt of the government. The government creates debt and the bank monetizes it. So, and that brings us to, I think, another irony of your stage one in your project. That is that you, because you're indirectly also have US treasuries on your balance sheet, you don't have it, but indirectly, right? And with your reserve tokens being money, you are also monetizing US government debt.
Yep. So yeah, so I would say that in the case of the, you know, you talked about sort of the two different reserve tokens. There's the one that's backed directly by US dollar stablecoins, and then there's the one that's backed by these, you know, compound or Aave tokens. For the first one, the thing that's happening within the reserve protocol itself, I think, doesn't include any, you know, money creation. Whereas in the second one, I guess technically within our smart contract, there's still not money creation, but because of the fact that those stable coins are getting lent out through a compound, like money creation is happening there because, you know, you have the person who deposited them into compound who, you know, has a balance, you know, and then you have the person who borrowed those coins sort of now has a balance. And so you are getting basically the same pattern of, you know, the expansion of how many units of currency people feel like they have through that system. And then for the, even for the first stablecoin, it's still the case that there's these underlying US dollar balances in the banking system that, as you said, you know, are maybe being held by the bank in the form of treasuries or something else. So yeah, I mean, really, like, I think what you're pointing at is accurate. And so, yeah, so it really is the case that what we're doing now is just making essentially existing US dollar, you know, balances and transactions available to people in parts of the world that, you know, especially want them and especially have trouble getting them. It's really no innovation in like the nature of money or currency or even like, you know, how these balances really work. I mean, it's just a different sort of technological delivery method, and it does have to do with, what is regulatorily feasible to offer to these people. And then, yeah, and in the future, you know, then we do start to get into something that's interesting and different that uses the same protocol. But yeah, for now, we really aren't doing anything innovative when it comes to like how money works.
Yeah. All right. Excellent. So this has already taught me a lot about stablecoins, in the sense that it sort of reaffirmed a lot of the things that I noticed when I compared it to regular banking. So thank you very much. I hope that the audience is finding this just as interesting as I am. Let me just ask you a bit of a question about your experiences in Venezuela. So I read that about 8,000 people are already using this at the moment. Is that correct?
Well, there's about 8,000 merchants where you can go and buy things directly with it. There's on a weekly basis, about 100,000 people open up the Reserve app. And there's about 55,000 that we count as like substantially financially active who are using it today. And to give you a sense of the total usage, I think it's around, I forget the exact numbers, but I think it's like $19 million in transactions per month by consumers, and like $45 million in transactions per month via businesses. That's about the scale that we're at right now.
Yeah. And all of this money is entering circulation via dollars, right, at the moment, via these intermediaries.
Yeah, that's right. So it's like, somebody mints the stable coins, somebody mints the reserve tokens, you know, liquidity providers end up buying those reserve tokens and then sell them to end users and buy them back from end users.
Yeah, because if I can tie that a little bit to, for example, the case of Lebanon, which I did a video about, and so I know a little bit more about than Venezuela, because I think this is something where you have Lebanon in mind as well, right? That would be an ideal use case.
Yep.
So one problem that they have, I think, so they're very close to hyperinflation, but that's being caused for a large part by them running a massive long-term, very unsustainable current account or trade deficit, meaning that a lot of money is consistently sort of flowing out of that country, you know, leading for their currency to crash. And then, you know, what dollarization does is very valuable to some of the people in Lebanon. So I'm not going to criticize that, but I am going to point out a problem with it. And that is that money is leaving that country, including dollars. And I wonder how you see that, because I think, or how it seems to me, your system will help people get easier access to dollars, but it won't help with that problem that dollars are leaving the country. Do you see what I'm saying?
I think so, because it's like, if people take their Lebanese pounds or lira, depending on your lingo, and they use those to buy dollars, you know, in our system or in cash or what have you, you know, that is, you know, a reduction in demand for the local currency. Is that the main thing that you're talking about?
So what I'm talking about is just that people are spending all of the dollars they have on imports, not all, of course, but a lot. So currency is leaving that country. And what I wanted to do is tie into a little bit the title of this video, or at least the description, where we compared it a little bit to the IMF, right? I said, oh, you're going to replace the IMF with this currency. Might have been a bit of an exaggeration. But one role that the IMF plays is the lender, being a lender of last resort. So how that can help a country in a situation like this is that it puts money, you know, a lot of money it brings to that country, and that might help it get off its back on its feet in a way, in the sense that it might use that to build an industry. And I think that your project might be extremely interesting sort of for a bigger solution to hyperinflation in these countries, if it can build an element of something like that into it. What do you think of that?
It's an interesting idea. I mean, we certainly don't have any system to make large-scale loans to countries in distress like the IMF. You know, it's a piece of infrastructure that could be used if the IMF or another lender wanted to. But in terms of having that capital to lend, there's, you know, we sort of currently don't have any way to do that. But it's an interesting idea. Like, are you seeing some way that are you imagining that capital would come from people in the crypto world, or like, how would you imagine that working?
Yeah, that's a good point. I don't see it coming from in the crypto world, because typically this is being done by governments, because private investors don't want to do that because they're typically too small to turn it around. This can be a very profitable investment for a country or an IMF, or, you know, is profitable, but only because they can do it on such a large scale. Right. But one thing that I was thinking would be interesting for you is if people could use collateral that is actually available to them, because then they could start minting their own reserve tokens in the country, if that makes sense. Do you see what I mean with that? So that they can create money inside the country rather than being reliant on dollars from outside the country, which are flowing out.
Right, totally. Yeah, and the challenge there is the tokenization. So if you can... How do I talk usefully about this? Like, let's say that a country had a bunch of gold and it wanted to make that more usable as a currency. You know, like, as a side anecdote, there's like one region in Venezuela where little pieces of gold sometimes are used as currency because they sort of have so much of it floating around. But that's not, you know, if you wanted to sort of take that asset and be like, okay, let's back a new currency with that, and let's use this technological system to do it, you would need some way to credibly tokenize it, to basically offer that, you know, initial sort of similar to the US dollar stablecoins we've been discussing, of like, okay, you bring us X amount of gold, we give you Y amount of tokens, and then you can always redeem them for the same rate. And so that could happen. The challenge there, I think, is often that if there's a country that's in so much distress that they're undergoing hyperinflation, often the institutions that, you know, that would have had the most credibility to issue, to actually tokenize something and like provide that promise, people wouldn't necessarily trust them anymore. So people wouldn't necessarily trust, you know, government banks or even commercial banks necessarily to do that. Maybe they would. Maybe there's private institutions that would retain sufficient trust. But part of the way I've thought about it is that we're sort of, well, anyway, that's a more complicated thought. But so I can see where you're going with that. And I think it's a cool idea. I haven't really seen a way to do that yet, because it just tends to be that I think tokenization efforts in these countries would be less credible than things that are tokenized in, you know, some other place in Switzerland or the US or Singapore or some place that has trust in institutions when it comes to that redeemability.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. I know that that's why it hasn't been done, because it's extremely difficult, right? But this is something I, you know, when I read your protocol, I was thinking, okay, because especially since you are very big on decentralization, right? If a person could actually do that themselves in, for example, a smart contract, that I think would absolutely be transformative. But, you know, I know it's a pipe dream.
It's a super interesting idea. I've thought about, like, could we somehow make it so that, like, anyone can kind of issue their own mini tokenized whatever and then have something that's backed by all of that? That would be incredible. And then the challenge there is, like, because you can't really do the creditworthiness assessment on that massive scale, at least I don't know how to do that in a decentralized way, then the only way I can imagine is, like, well, if their balance was somehow over collateralized, but it's like, well, but if it's already over collateralized, then, like, what's the point of them tokenizing the real world asset? They could just have something backed by whatever the on-chain collateral already is. So I think it is a pipe dream, but I think it's a useful pipe dream. And I try to tell the people on my team, you know, something doesn't have to be a good plan for it to be a good idea. I think that's a good idea, even though I don't really see a way for it to work yet. And it's a good idea because it's, like, it's worth thinking about. And maybe there's something in the area that can be figured out. And if so, that would be really cool.
Yeah. Hey, there's one thing I want to talk to you about still. And then I think I'll just let people ask questions, because I've already seen some questions in the chat specifically about, how easy it is to block you in a way. But you can answer that to them. But there's one more question that I wanted to ask you, and then I'm just going to bring back the balance sheets, because I know that this is something that regulators worry about. So you are on the radar of central banks. I'm sure you are aware of it, and that might become tricky for you at some point, because they are looking at you as a danger to financial stability. And the reason is that you are, like these very liquid banks, you are building a monetary system on top, indirectly, on assets like USD Treasury and repo and asset-backed securities. And what I read in your paper, so maybe we can first get into that, is that you think this is much better than building it on top of your own speculative token. Because some stablecoins also issue a speculative token and then use that to sort of not, I think they didn't sort of use them directly to buy that, but sort of used it as collateral, I think. You can probably explain that better than me. But what I read in your paper is that you were saying, well, that approach has a cyclicality in it, in the sense that if that token goes up, liquidity of those, if the speculative token goes up, liquidity of those stable coins goes up. But if the speculative token will go down a lot, then the liquidity of those stable coins will go down a lot. And as I understood it, you were saying, we're not going to do that. We are going to use, at least in the first stage, the USD coins, repo, USD treasuries, because they are independent from how well our stablecoin is doing. There's not this positive feedback loop. Is that a correct summary?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. And I totally agree with that analysis. I think that's a very safe choice. However, one thing I was wondering if you had taken into account, this, what you are doing is happening on a massive scale. Not only are you doing this, a lot of other stablecoins are doing this, which are getting pretty big, I understood. At the same time, the repo market is insanely massive, and the banking system has been moving towards this sort of model on a large scale as well. And what you have now sometimes seen is that USD Treasury is not as safe anymore. We saw this, for example, when COVID first hit. And I actually got burned by this a little bit because I thought, oh, okay, I own some USD treasuries. And I figured, oh, that's the safest thing that can happen. But they actually went down like crazy. And a lot of scholars are arguing the reason for that is that they are all acting as collateral for a lot of highly liquid sort of liabilities. And so what you had is that you got fire sales in these very stable assets, which are in a way irrational, but because everybody was selling, because that's sort of when all of these contracts activate, like, oh, the collateral is going down in value too much, we need to sell, or we need to sell our repos, for example. So my point is, even if you're not doing that on an individual level, perhaps you're doing this on a, you're contributing to doing this on a systematic level. What do you think about that?
Interesting idea. So are you saying that, like, if I go deposit $1,000 into Bank of America, that the Bank of America will end up holding similar assets like repos and USD treasuries? Or are you saying that, like, for normal bank balances, say in the US, those balances are backed by something else than, you know, than this sort of collateral?
Right. Okay. So actually, perhaps the deposits are not the best example, because of course, US banks also still have a lot of mortgages and loans to businesses and all of that. But it seems that there has sort of been a large shadow bank system, you know, is being built that have other liabilities, such as repo liabilities, but also wholesale funding, which is another name for interbank lending. And then they have used as collateral for that USD treasuries. But what happened is that when there was less trust, they tried to get rid of these liabilities, and then they all had to sell this USD treasury, which was over-collateralized and was also... now, I think the main message is that it is over-collateralized, but that because they were all doing this, had to do this at the same time, one of the safest assets on Earth was still crashing. And it was because of that system.
Yeah. So, and the reason why I ask about... Because I'm just like, this is interesting, and I'm not personally super familiar. I'm just not familiar with what, you know, with the trends in what, you know, banks are essentially investing in. And so, like, I sort of spend my time thinking about, you know, the layer of, you know, collateralization that we're building on the blockchain and the end user software. And I've basically been assuming that, you know, Circle and Coinbase say that you know, issue USDC, that they're doing responsible enough things with that capital, and that the underlying, you know, banking institutions involved are doing responsible enough things with that capital. If that's not true, then that's a problem. It's not a problem that I'm familiar with yet, but I'm certainly curious to understand it if it is a problem. So, you know, if I guess I know we're like a little bit over the hour already, I'd be curious to talk more about that, whether on this stream or at another time, because that's not something that's on my radar, but it's something that I would like to understand if that's an issue.
Yeah.
What I will say, though, is that I do foresee a similar issue to what you described potentially in the long-term version of this that we're aiming for. And this is something that keeps me up at night. So let me try to explain it to you. So let's say that we, in the future, we get to the point where we have some further reserve stablecoin that's backed by a diversified basket of tokenized assets that are not fiat currencies. So the simplest canonical example would just be like tokenized gold, right? And, you know, hopefully there'd be like lots of other tokenized commodities and maybe even equities if laws allow for that and so on and so forth, like maybe debt, whatever. But let's just say it's just tokenized gold and some other stuff. Well, if the protocol ends up being very successful and you have, you know, sort of trillions of dollars worth of value being stored in this currency and transacted in this currency, well, that would then have created a lot of demand for tokenized gold, which would create a lot of demand for gold to like be locked up and tokenized. And so you might actually, at some point, you'd end up influencing the market price of gold and of any other asset that has been sort of sucked up into the system. And then if there was some negative demand shock where all of a sudden, you know, 25% of the supply of the reserve token were redeemed and sort of all dumped at once, you could get the same effect that you were just talking about with treasuries, where you know if everyone is then, you know, all of a sudden demand for all these different assets is going down all at once, well then the value of them could be driven down, and so then the value of the remaining currency that hasn't been redeemed would correspondingly go down. And I don't really see a way around that. One sort of vague idea is like, well, if it's diversified enough, if it's like super, 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 super diversified, so that you're trying to effectively sort of like index, you know, the entire set of assets and the entire economy in the world, then maybe you have some sort of situation where this is not like a sort of academic thought. This is a sort of dumb, you know, simple thought. But like if you think about it, it's like whenever someone sells some asset, they're buying something else. Like the capital sort of has to go somewhere. So it's all sloshing from like one bucket to another back and forth all the time. And so the sort of simple intuition is like, well, if you can manage to index like the entire thing, like all of it, then even if one thing is going down, something else sort of has to be going up in terms of demand. And if you've managed to index across that, then maybe your index stays more stable than any one sort of sub part of that index. Now, I don't know if it's logistically or legally feasible to end up, you know, building an index that's that diversified, but that's kind of like a fundamental intuition that, you know, that makes me curious about this possibility of having a currency that kind of, you know, so-called like indexes the global economy.
Yeah.
And that's one way to maybe deal with the problem you're talking about. Because when people were dumping treasuries, well, they were moving that capital into something, right? They were buying something. And so if you had a combination of treasuries and whatever it was that the capital was moving into, then maybe you would have been okay in that moment.
So one thing I want to add to this, yeah, and then we're going to open it to everyone else, and I'll pick out the best questions for you from the chat. Or you can do that yourself as well, you're watching. Let's do that. But before going there, I think what we have now done at the end of the conversation is sort of went a little bit speculative, the both of us did, because this is also an issue that I have to dive deeper in further. The one thing I want to say about your thought experiment is that capital can also expand and contract. And so it is, I think, possible for everything to go up at the same time. And that's an idea that is also known as on the global level, it's known as the global financial cycle, which is a great paper by famous economist Helene Ray, which is talking about this in an international context. But that's just a bit of extra reading. We're going to go into these types of subjects, I'm sure, in more depth at some other point, but I think we've talked about so much already that I just want to open the floor for questions. And actually, if you want to, you can pick out your own questions. And otherwise, I see that people have been looking at the balance sheets for quite a while now. If you want to, you can pick out your own questions.
How do you spell the name of, just real fast, how do you spell the name of the author of that paper?
I will post it in the chat. Yeah, the Helene Ray. I'm missing an ampersand, I think, but she's French. That's the paper. Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating stuff. I'm teaching it in the next course, the next semester. But yeah,
hopefully I'll read it, and if not, hopefully you'll make a video that explains it faster than I can read it. Okay. Yeah. So there's a lot of chatter here. I guess I'll just scroll through and look for interesting questions.
Yeah, I can also do it for you if you want, but I figured, you know, you have a different perspective on this.
So this is something that, I mean, I kind of have this question for you because I don't have this historical understanding. So Zybernetics says there's historical precedence in the private currency era of the US for private ledger money creating massive problems and exacerbating the business cycle. Always ends in disaster. I'm curious for your thoughts on that, if you have any, and with the parallels you see here.
Okay, no, I wasn't prepared for that. Can you just repeat the question for me?
Yeah, so Zybernetics says there's historical precedence in the private currency era of the US for private ledger money creating massive problems and exacerbating the business cycle. Always ends in disaster. That defunct era is why we have the Fed now to act as regulator and interbank clearinghouse.
Right, yeah. So he's talking about the, I think, the era of free banking, which is just pre-Fed.
Yeah.
End of the 19th century, which I have to do a bit of more research on, because I just did this video on banking and central banking, starting in medieval Europe and going to England of the 18th century. And people also told me then, like, look into free banking era more, because in the US there are two narratives about this. One is that free banking was amazing and that the Fed screwed it all up. And the other one is that free banking was extremely unstable. And that's why the Fed was created. I have to do more research on the specifics because, you know, I'm in Europe and I studied more of the European case studies. But I think that the question is referring to something that I covered in one of my videos that I now is called Banks and Bubbles. And that is that private money creation in the form of banks, and that goes into more credit, has a positive feedback loop with asset bubbles. So if private money creation expands, then more assets can be bought. And then if those assets go up in value, especially if they're collateral, then it's easier also to make more loans and hence increase sort of private money creation even further. And there is a sort of, yeah, quite logically a big positive feedback loop between these two. However, the thing is with many asset prices, at some point there will be a turning point, and then exactly the same positive feedback loop will drive it back downwards, right? So for example, in a housing bubble or something, you know, if house prices start to fall, then banks will lend out less money, making house prices fall even faster, making banks go out of business. So there's again this positive feedback loop, and I think that's what they mean with the question that that private money creation amplifies the business cycle, whereas the business cycle is more referring to real economy, which also might be have some smaller fluctuations. And I think they're maybe afraid that you're doing that in the crypto world, being somewhat like a bank.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's legitimate to raise such concerns. You know, I think that a lot of entrepreneurs in the cryptocurrency world are sort of very quickly reinventing a bunch of prior financial structures without really having had any experience in those domains. It's important to have conversations about what's happened in the past and not, you know, not do things totally blindly. And the interesting thing about that is that, like, you know, when you're in like my position of the entrepreneur trying to do something like this, you end up totally consumed by the operational challenge of making it work. You know, like I'm totally consumed by, you know, making sure that our app is functioning in Venezuela and making sure that our next protocol release is going to work and not have any bugs and so on and so forth. And like, obviously we think about the economics of how these things are going to function, but we end up, I think we end up not being able to, like, sort of not having the luxury of spending as much time to do background research and have exploratory conversations and, like, you know, think through and do wargaming to, like, understand all of this, you know, perfectly in advance based on everything that's happened in history. So that's part of why I was excited to talk to you, and, you know, why I sometimes like watching your channel is, you know, just trying to, you know, not repeat things that have happened in the past without understanding them. It is tough as an entrepreneur to have, you know, to find the time and energy to do that sufficiently.
Yeah, I know what you mean a little bit, in the sense that I also sometimes get consumed in just making animations for the channel, right? And then all of the stuff that comes with it. But I have to say that I'm impressed how open-minded you are about these things, and also how much you have already read about all of this. So I have really enjoyed this conversation, I have to say.
Yeah, likewise. One user was following the numbers about our transactions, and they thought that there were only 1 million reserve tokens in circulation. I think that's just an error of coin market cap. I think there's 17 million in circulation right now. So the velocity of money isn't quite as high as that arithmetic would indicate. Scrolling through, looking for more questions.
Yeah, I ask people to repeat as well. So I think you can also look at the bottom.
Okay, perhaps. All right, I'll do that. So Patrick asks, you know, why would reserve stablecoin be better for citizens in hyperinflating countries compared to Bitcoin, aside from price fluctuations? Well, the main reason is price fluctuations. So, you know, there's also the transactability of different crypto assets in terms of the time and cost to transact them. But like Ethereum is having, you know, just as much issue with this as Bitcoin is right now, that whole network. So yeah, the main thing is price fluctuations. That's really, you know, in Venezuela in particular, for example, Bitcoin and Dash have both been tried as alternatives, and there was a lot of excitement about them for a while. But ultimately, that didn't stick because of the price fluctuations. You know, merchants, you know, ended up holding a bag that was worth a lot less than they thought it would be. Like, I'm not just making that up. Like, that is really concretely what happened. We have people on our team who were part of the Dash movement in Venezuela, who tried to get, you know, crypto to be used in Venezuela and made a bunch of progress. But then a lot of that went away, you know, when the market turned down the last time and everybody lost a lot of money. So I think, yeah, stable coins are really the only usable form of cryptocurrency if you want to use it as normal money.
And is it also the other way around, Nevin? Because I think most people make the example when it crashes, that that it really crashes. But I think it's also, is it also a way that if it goes up, that merchants are just not inclined to spend their money?
Right, yeah. And it means that, like, as an individual, you have to make an investment decision every time you're making a purchasing decision of, like, do you want to reduce your, you know, the amount of this asset that is currently going up? So I think it's just really not feasible for Bitcoin or any volatile crypto asset to be used as currency.
I think there are also some nice questions now about how your system compares to other stable coins.
Yeah. So how is the system better than using DAI? Is a good good question. What advantages does it have over Terra suite of paid coins? So the, like, I think that the Maker protocol is actually pretty sound in how it works. I don't think that DAI is going to break its peg. There's, like, possibility of, like, very intense flash crash that would lead the DAI system to be under-collateralized. I guess I'm just answering this for someone who already understands Maker. Yuri, do you understand Maker, and are you interested in understanding it?
I am interested, but I think that that would take, I'm afraid that will take quite a long time to explain. I'm actually talking to someone from a cryptocurrency called Liquidity on the 22nd of November. And for that, I'm going to dive a little bit more into the, I think the more, yeah, I think that that one is more comparable to DAI. So I will get into that at length then myself, but yeah, I haven't really answered your question, perhaps.
Well, I'll just say something brief about it. And as you're researching it, you might find this interesting. So the thing about Maker is it does allow anyone to, you know, to kind of tokenize an asset and issue a stable coin in the way that we had talked about. But it is via that on-chain over-collateralized approach. So you have to come and deposit collateral that's worth more than the amount of stable coin that you want to, like, mint. And so you can deposit, you know, $200 worth of ETH to mint, like, $100 worth of DAI, roughly. And you can do that with other tokens. And so the cool thing about that is that you can create actually a significantly more decentralized stablecoin than Reserve, because it's not, it doesn't have to be based on those underlying dollar deposits or fiat-backed stablecoins. The problem with that is that if the demand for the stablecoin goes up, that doesn't actually incentivize more people to create stablecoins. There isn't actually an arbitrage loop that that makes it so that greater demand leads to sustained greater supply. And so you'll probably see this as you research Maker. They ended up solving that by essentially making it so that you can also basically just tokenize stablecoins, fiat-backed stablecoins, to create DAI as well. And so the original Maker design sort of failed, but the project, I think, figured out the correct answer, which is just to allow people to create DAI by tokenizing fiat-backed stablecoins, mainly USDC, maybe only USDC, as well as basically borrowing DAI against volatile collateral. And so, yeah, so basically, I think that that was a legitimate move. And as far as, like, you know, yeah, go ahead.
Is this correct? Can you see this, what I've drawn here? Is that... So what you mean, like the DAI coins and then over-collateralized either, but now it's also stable coins?
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay, excellent. Okay, so there was another question that I think a lot of people asked. Bert just asked it. Why would a government not ban your applications like we see now in Turkey, China, to prevent money from leaving the country?
I think in some cases they would. And so, you know, under some circumstances, I think that the system that we're providing would be very difficult to provide, maybe impossible. But like in the case of Venezuela, the government, even though they haven't officially dollarized, they've sort of embraced the use of US dollars. And the limitations on access to US dollars are often more about external problems with sanctions, for instance. And so at least at present, we're not facing any opposition from the Venezuelan government in offering this service to their citizens. But in a country like China, I imagine that the service that we offer wouldn't be welcome to allow people to convert a sort of unlimited amount of local currency into US dollars and move that capital abroad. And so there are ways of still making that service available where you sort of fully decentralize the on and off ramp and allow anyone to be an independent liquidity provider so that people can actually do those trades peer-to-peer. And there are services like that that people do use in countries like China. But even with a service like that, the government can ask the banks to find people with those accounts and shut those accounts down over and over again. And they can sort of push back against those services. And actually, that's happening in Nigeria right now. There's like peer-to-peer crypto trading services that are suffering significantly because the government has instructed the banks to basically look for those patterns and shut down those accounts. And so I think that the world hasn't really figured out any truly censorship-resistant way to offer, you know, totally unlimited liquidity in a country with that sort of strict desire to enforce capital controls. And so, yeah, and our application doesn't really solve that problem fully either.
All right, fair enough. Hey, I think we are getting at the end of our chat in the sense that it's dinner time for me. Nevin, I really enjoyed talking to you. Like I said, I think you showed that very much sort of an open mind and a willingness to learn more about how money works, which I think is absolutely great to see in the crypto sphere. This is also what draws me to the crypto space in the sense that there are so many people there interested in money. Might not always agree with the stuff that I post on my channel, I think that if we dive into stuff like we've seen here, that there are actually quite a few similarities, and that in a way crypto is the crypto space is reinventing finance as well, like you mentioned, which is super interesting. I will make some more videos about this, not immediately, but and I will talk also to the liquidity project on the 22nd of November. For now, thank you very much, Nevin. This stream will remain available on my homepage, and I plan to open a second channel where I might host the best clips of our conversation so that more people can enjoy them. And for now, thank you so much for joining, and I wish you the best of luck with this project, because I think it is coming from good intentions, and I really like to see that.
Yeah, thanks again for having me. I enjoyed speaking.
Excellent. Okay, cheers, and cheers, everybody.